Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today we have the whole crew back together again after a long summer of recording individual episodes. I'm here with Dr. Rosenblatt, Dr. Keith, and Dr. Francisco. So I think it's been like 8 or 9 episodes since we've all been in the same room together.
It's been at least since we've moved out of the San Juan house, so weeks.
Yeah, yes. It's been a long time. So we finally are all back together. Things are a little bit more normal. We're still not in our full studio, so we're in kind of a compromise.
We're still in limbo.
Studio. We have the old recording rig that we used to use set up right now, but we're in a nice echo-free room.
So it shouldn't matter.
So yeah, it's pretty good. My mic might sound different. It's different than everybody else's mics today, so we're just trying to get that all figured out. But we have a guest with us today. We have Wade Johnston here. How are you doing?
Doing well. Nice to be with you.
Wade is a author for 1517. You're a professor, right?
Well, yeah, we'll let him explain. Yeah. Introduce himself.
So, but he's coming on the show to talk about a book he just published with us and maybe some tidbits from a book he published in the spring.
Right, yeah. So, hey, Wade, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why don't you start out by just telling our listeners who you are, what you do? We were upstairs with our friends last night, and you kind of gave a great little background. Why don't you do that for us today?
Sure. Name, as was mentioned, is Wade Johnston. I teach theology at Wisconsin Lutheran College in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. My doctorate's actually in history, but Reformation history. And so the books, An Uncompromising Gospel, we'll be talking a little bit about later, is more in my wheelhouse, and then the Mark book we'll be talking about today, A Path Strewn with Sinners, kind of grew out of my own kind of personal study and interest. So live in Milwaukee, have 5 kids that my wife is wrangling by herself today between football. Apparently they got trounced.
Jeez, and Adam, it's like you're wasting time. You only have 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can work on that.
Yeah, no thanks.
But
I'll work on it.
We have 5 kids, and my wife is... Trisha is dutifully home taking care of them, and enjoy working with 1517 and writing with them so far. And sometimes you can hear me on my with my partner Peter Hermanson on a much smaller podcast and much less interesting, Let the Bird Fly.
You have a great website though.
Yeah, it is good.
Yeah, then we got 2 guys who do tech, so I don't know how to work it, but they manage it. So I just talk sometimes.
Good. Well, hey, welcome to the show. So why don't you? The Path Strewn with Sinners, basically what it is, it's a study of the Gospel of Mark, right? And it sort of came out of your study of the Gospel of Mark. Was this something you were doing with a congregation or just on your own?
You know, when I came out of seminary and you're preaching through, I was using the 3-year lectionary at first, and you get to year B, which I assume is year B for everybody, and it's all Mark. And I just dreaded that year because Jesus casts out a demon, Jesus heals someone, Jesus casts out a demon, and, you know, it's just brutal as... A new preacher, mm-hmm. You know, this week we're going to talk about Jesus cast out a demon.
Mm-hmm.
And and so Mark was by far...
There's always the epistle lesson.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I had gotten wise advice when I get out to preach the Gospels for a while, get a sense for the flow. And Mark was brutal, I thought. And as I studied it more, one of the things I came to appreciate was Mark got really fun when you actually looked at the details of the people that Jesus encounters there. So who is he healing and how is he healing them and where are they from in these backgrounds? As I looked at the Greek, another thing I really got interested in is Mark talked just like my grandpa used to talk, you know, worked Ford worker, worked in the Rouge plant, and then he says and then I says and then I seen and whatever
oh,
else.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Mark's Greek is very much like that. And it's just immediately everything's happening. You know, mm-hmm. Grandpa would come home and tell me about a week-long fishing trip, and it was, you know, like it was 15 minutes. Everything's just all happening. And he left out the best parts that I found out later, you know, at the funeral home from his drinking buddies. But you know, just the stories when you get into it and you look at the people that Jesus is dealing with, and especially in the north and with Gentiles or with people that are on the very fringes of society, Mark is really emphasizing this Jesus that is just consistently going to the last people you'd expect and reaching out and addressing people in ways you wouldn't expect. So.
You know, Rod used to have a house in Irvine. Blueberry. It was Blueberry, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he had a fireplace, and over the fireplace hung a picture. I think it's called The Outsiders,
mm-hmm.
Where it showed 2 cowboys So it's, the perspective is you're sitting in the church and you're looking out the church window. So you can kind of see some of the pews and you can see it's obviously a church window. They're looking out the church window and there's two cowboys out there sitting on their horses with their heads bowed.
Singing along. One of the two is singing along with the congregation.
Yeah. And it kind of, Rod always sort of explained it. That the reason he loves that picture is because that's Christ to the outsiders, right?
Yeah. The pastors would look at it and always feel ambivalent about it. Because these guys were outside the wall, and one guy's just a friend of the other guy, but the main guy has his hat off and is singing along with the congregation. The artist's name is Spalding. And that one I loved because there was a guy who believed as much as those who were inside the wall, but didn't want to be inside the wall.
Yeah, or couldn't be.
Yeah. Artist is Spalding.
And so Mark is the shows the Jesus to those people.
Yeah, I think if, you know, I don't want to belabor it because I think an excerpt went up on the website from...
Belabor away.
Yeah, you should do that because not everybody reads.
I would challenge, about anyone to find...
Why are you looking at me?
Oh, sorry.
I would challenge most people to find a more exciting chapter in the Gospels than Mark 5. You have the healing of the demoniac where Jesus cast the demons into this herd of pigs, and he's the crazy man in town. He's apparently not usually dressed because when they see him clothed later, they're surprised. And I tend to think if you have a buddy and you're like, hey, so and so was wearing clothes, he must not wear clothes a fair amount of the time.
Yeah. And showed up today and he had clothes on.
Yeah, he was wearing pants.
Palestinian Diogenes or something. Yeah.
But this, and he lives in the tombs, and he cuts himself all night, and he howls, and he's, they can't chain him. He breaks the chains, and he's the first man to greet Jesus in this Gentile region, and, with these great herd of pigs. And so emphasizing the Gentileness of it, after the gospel, bacon is a great New Testament gift. And and he sends these demons into the pigs, and, about 2,000 go and drown. And, just picturing the scene, I lived on a pig farm for a year, and it... The screaming, the noise,
We don't always get guests who say I lived on a pig farm for a year.
My vicar year, that's where they put me up, is we lived on a pig farm, and I always joke, they were screaming all night and it bothered my wife, but I was from Detroit, so I was kind of used to it. But
it lulled you right to sleep.
But what do they do? He's just ruined their economy, and they come to Jesus and say, hey, you should leave. And the one sane man now is the demoniac who's been healed, and he says, let me go with you too. And Jesus says, no vocation, right? Mm-hmm. You stay here. You live among these people, and you can tell your walking testimony to what I've done for you. And then what do we get next in Mark 5 is the Syrophoenician woman who says, I'll be your dog. If
the woman Jesus called
a
dog.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, what a pericope.
Yeah.
And just all that in one chapter, and, it's making a point.
Yeah. Hey, why don't you tell the Syrophoenician woman story? I mean, that's one of my favorites in all of the Gospels.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd say that the prodigal son and, the
centurion.
Yeah, absolutely.
The, you get to, it's the second half, it immediately follows the demoniac account, and you have Jairus comes, who's this prominent man in town, and he wants Jesus to come and to heal his daughter, who's ill and dying. He's a ruler of the synagogue, so a good Jew. And he says, please come and lay your hands on her to save her. And you just have to imagine the nerves that go into him approaching Jesus, as a prominent Jew.
Yeah.
And Jesus says, okay. And so they're going to head on their way. And, any of us who've ever had a child who's been ill, I'm the panicker in the family. My wife will be calm. But, I remember one time I was at a pastor's conference and I was driving back and my wife called and she was panicked. And so I knew it was bad. And she said, Anna fell over the stairs.
Oh.
And Anna had been stealing all her brother's sweet tarts, and she climbed over the railing, and her mouth was full of sweet tarts, and they found her, and she was just...
aspirating.
And the first thing she said when she came to was, I didn't take their candy.
of course.
Which, of course, she did. But I get a call from a member of the congregation who was an EMT and said, I heard your daughter fell out the window. And I said, out the window? This is worse than I thought. And I'm racing home, and I just remember the panic. And so if you think of Jairus,
Desperate.
Yeah, completely desperate. And this woman comes and disrupts it all, and she touches Jesus. And Jesus could have just let it go, and what does Jesus do? He says, "Who touched me?" And, of course, we're back in the garden, you know, Genesis 3.
Yeah.
And he knows who touched her. He wants this encounter.
Yep.
Or I'm sorry, now I'm getting ahead of myself here, but he wants this encounter. And we have a Jesus who's distracted. And we get to Jairus then, and Jairus' daughter is saved. And the next thing that follows on that now, the next person we're encountering is going to be Mark 7, right, the way the book goes. So you've got Syrophoenician, I keep calling her, the woman with the flow of blood, and now we're going to get to the Syrophoenician woman in a path strewn with sinners, at least, because I'm not taking every chapter. I'm looking at the main characters.
Sure.
Yeah. And so this is who kind of...
You're looking at the sinners.
Right, the past room of sinners. And so now we get to the Syrophoenician woman. Jesus does raise Jairus' daughter. He says not to tell anyone. But you have this, you know, Mark is just racing us. And so we're going in... Jairus is here, the one racing, and Jesus slows down. And now we're going to get the next thing is going to be the Syrophoenician woman. And she comes to Jesus desperate too. And I'm getting some of these a little bit jumbled. But Jesus gives this answer to her that seems, you know.
Well, she comes and she touches him, right? She grabs his cloak.
No, that's
the one with the blood.
This is with Jairus.
Now I'm confused.
And now we're to the Syrophoenician woman. And no, because I said Syrophoenician earlier. But now we're to Mark 7, and we have this woman who's going to come to Jesus, and she's calling out. And Jesus is racing again. So this is what I was trying to get at.
Yeah.
So Jesus had stopped when he should be racing, and now Jesus is racing again, walking, and the disciples say, tell this woman to stop calling out. You know, she's annoying us. Send her away.
She goes to the lackeys, as Jim Nestigan would say, yeah, to the underlings.
Yeah, and so now we have a Jesus who is on the go, and why is he not stopping? And he says what seems to be, now, I'm not saying Jesus is racist. I just want a disclaimer. But a normal Jew saying this to the Syrophoenician woman, it could be taken as a very dismissive thing because of her background. Where he says, I've come for Israel. It's not right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs.
Yeah. So can you, and if not someone else, can you explain what Syrophoenician is for the listeners? I mean, what that means and why Jesus might have a reaction like that to her, or why a normal Jew would have a reaction like that to her.
Sure. I don't know if anybody else wants to jump in. Otherwise, I can. I'm talking.
Go for it. We flew you out here.
So yeah. You know, it's just a non. She's not ethnically Jewish. Right. She's not. This is a Gentile. This is, and for someone who's not ethically Jewish to be approaching Jesus, in the first place would be noticeable, but to be doing so in such a
brazen.
Yeah, you know, she just won't stop.
Yeah. And, so she's gone around pestering the disciples, essentially, so pestering his followers.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about Jim Neskin's account is he says she knows how to get to the man. You have to get to the man through the people that you know, sort of are the controllers of the man, telling him where
the entourage.
The entourage.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
If you want to talk to the rock star, you got to get to the crew first, you know, and that's exactly what she does.
And now, yeah, so we've had now Jesus, who has dealt with this demoniac, this crazy man, and ruined a town's economy, and now slowed up trying to heal Jairus. And now he won't stop walking away. He's a Jesus, by all accounts, on the run away from her, and she won't stop. And so he says, you know, it's not right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. And, you know, I
literally calling her a dog in the process.
Yeah. And what would our response be? What would almost any Americans?
Well, these days.
You sexist, racist pig.
Yeah.
And she, you know, one of the things I love about this section is she catches him in his words, which is precisely where Christ wants to be caught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't have a much more Lutheran thing to do there, but I've now caught you. And she says, okay, we'll play that game. I'll take the crumbs. I'll be your dog, right, so long as I get your crumbs. And we see what faith does. Faith just persistently clings to Christ and says, any gift from you is a good gift. And so we see in that span of those three accounts in a path strewn with sinners, back to back to back, Jesus with three outsiders, and then the one from the religious elite, but that's the one he holds up for, right? He's going to make time for eventually is going to be the demoniac. He's going to stop for the woman who comes and touches him. And then eventually he's going to make her run a bit, but he's going to stop for the Syrophoenician woman.
I love the sense in the – and Jim Nestigan first pointed this out to me in a lecture, the sense in the account of the Syrophoenician woman, how she's literally already converted. And mm-hmm. she's not necessarily converted on the basis of direct testimony out of Christ's mouth. Mm-hmm. And the way Jim says it is the gospel is so powerful that she's converted by on the basis of a rumor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a...
Wow.
That's a... When we think of... I mean, this may be a bit of a stretch, but I even think about sort of why we exist as a show and why 1517 as an organization exists. We often say it's to proclaim the gospel to as many people as we can, as many ways as we can. Try to do it, you know, explain it concisely. And some people ask why. And the reality is that for me, this story, this account of Christ is why. Because the gospel itself, there's so much power promised in that it can convert. I mean, bring people from death to life on the basis of just having heard it secondhand or a rumor. And it's a powerful, powerful account in Mark, and one that is sort of easy to overlook, especially in our day, because it can seem kind of at least exclusionary, if not outwardly sexist and racist, right? It can seem like Christ is actually building up barriers,
right,
rather than opening big doors.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way that you put it, you know, that she was caught in the words that he wanted her to speak, you know, and, you know, what a trap to lay. And that's exactly what he does for us. You know, the words that when we finally do give that confession, you know, that there's no other hope but you are the way to eternal life. Those are the words that we were given to speak, and the trap that he lays for us is in the gospel. And it's an amazing account. I mean, one that I think we don't spend enough time on, and that like some of the parables is absolutely earth-shattering and really shows that Christ is the God of the outsiders. He is the God of sinners. He is the one who came in and turned things on their head, right? Mm-hmm. You're going and you're talking to the demoniacs. You're going and talking to the Canaanite women. You're going and talking to women who are menstruating, you know, and interacting with them. You are not doing at all what the culture, what the religious elites, what even just the religious followers of the day would expect you to do. Mm-hmm. You're doing the unexpected. And sometimes when I'm out teaching this on being dad and talking about Luke 15, the parable of the prodigal son, I talk about what a countercultural story it is in his day and in ours.
Mm-hmm.
And this is right with that, I think.
Yeah, and it, you know, the woman you get who, you know, you have Jairus as the synagogue ruler, and you would think Jesus would be, surely his disciples are like, let's take care of this one. You know, this is a prominent guy.
Right.
And the woman that comes, all we know about her is that she has this flow of blood. And she's exhausted her money on doctors, right? She's tried everything.
Yep.
And, you know, the boldness just to go up and touch Jesus. And then the servants come. Jesus waits, and Jairus' daughter dies. And what is the religious response? Well, why bother the teacher any longer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, Jesus takes us as a Lazarus moment,
No,
still bother me. And
right.
And that's what the woman with the flow of blood was doing, and that's what Jairus and the demoniac.
You think my power is limited here.
Yeah.
You know?
So bother away, you know, and rather than...
ask for the outrageous.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like C.S. Lewis, right, that our problem, the problem isn't that we, what does he say, that we...
Ask for
so much. It's that we expect too little.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that it's not that we are pestering Jesus because we're asking too much. It's that our imagination is so limited that we don't get that the almighty creator of the heaven and earth, the one who spoke and brought all things into existence, could speak and bring anything into existence, even your life back. And it's just... You know, it's phenomenal. I mean, the accounts that you get here, they're nothing more than life-bringing.
Yeah.
So.
And with that same theme to the outsiders, we have gotten in the West so, quote, Christian-minded that we've picked up all the junk instead of picking up the treasure.
Right.
And so we get this sort of piety that's killing us. And if we look back to what he did, particularly in the Gospel of Mark, that isn't what he did at all. It was just the opposite. It was the ones that we shun that he bolts to.
Right.
Yeah. With the example of these women, I think a contemporary analog would be if you can imagine the imagery you see on the news or whatever of women under the Taliban. You know, they're
right.
just completely sequestered from public life.
Yep,
and right. Especially a menstruating woman. She's
yep.
stuck inside. You ought not go near her. And
that's what's happening here.
That's exact. Jesus is going into the house,
yeah. uh-huh.
into the room, an unclean room,
uh-huh.
of the, if you will, the lowest of the lows in society.
Well,
in terms
and allowing
of social
them
hierarchy.
To touch him. Yeah.
yeah. Well, that's a great picture. It's kind of like imagine a woman, you know, in the Middle East in a full hijab, right? Adam, am I saying that right?
Yeah. yeah.
Approaching one of the most popular mm-hmm. Muslim preachers mm-hmm. in our current day, and just walking past all of his toadies and pushing them out of the way and going up and grabbing his robe and in his face directly asking for him for something. I mean, that'd be even for us in the West, who kind of have a little bit of an idea what that culture is like, would be a noticeable
yeah.
exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I love it.
I think it's Acts 17 in Thessalonica where Paul's there, you know, and there's kind of he goes to the synagogue as was his custom, and then there are all those when the Jews come after Paul. There's that great line in there. It says these men who have turned the world upside down have come here now.
Oh,
like
I love
the
that. Yeah.
It's the gospel is so revolutionary, if you will.
Turn the world
like
upside down.
So much, yeah, it turns yeah. the whole. Order that man has made
mm-hmm. upside
that
down
that man thinks is objective or real or whatever turns it completely upside down.
Yeah.
You know, what was counterintuitive actually is the reality.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I one of the fascinating things with Mark too is if it is based on sermons, which there's more and more evidence that there's sermonic qualities to this, and you know, there's always the theory which I play on here and I say I can't prove it, but if this some of these are even Peter's sermons, what are these preaching again and again is that ultimately when we're brought to the point of recognizing we have nothing left to lean on, not myself, not someone else, not anything else, then all of a sudden Christ becomes big. And he's, you know, that is what there is. And these people in these encounters, just taking 5 through 7, are left with nothing else to look to but to Christ. And the interesting thing with the demoniac is this is one of the first, if not the first time, someone confesses who Jesus is in Mark's gospel.
They're the first ones.
And this is put in, you know, this is put in the mouth of this guy who they can't chain and lives with the dead.
Yeah.
And then he's the one who is truly alive and sane and free at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in those three accounts that were mentioned, even Jairus, the synagogue ruler, is brought to the point of, I got nothing else to do but go ask this guy preaching, this itinerant preacher in my area to come, you know, heal my daughter. And I mean, there was, Jesus seldom gives a lot of rebukes in Mark's gospel to these outsiders. You know, they're mm-hmm. at the point where mm-hmm. what they need is restoration, is freedom. You know, he doesn't need to come and say, you know, well, how did you behave yesterday?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're at the point that this is,
yeah.
they just need
yeah,
him.
Yeah, that kind of piety is in desperate need of being turned on its head. And we're thick with it in America. What people turn away from, I think, in general, the ones who become nuns, N-O-N-E-S, is a caricature against what the text actually says. He finds the outsiders, the unmentionables, the absolute opposite of every Sunday in church people, and makes them paradigm.
Yeah.
And we've so abused that or gone unconscious to it that the impression, well, primarily Wesleyanism in the Second Great Awakening, that the picture of Christianity is somebody who doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't
That's
this,
right.
doesn't that. And it's there, and it's wide, and it's deep, and it's broad in the culture.
Or the picture of Christianity is like the people in the pews in that picture instead of like the cowboy on the outside.
Yep.
You know, and it's a that's a bad picture. It's certainly not the picture that Mark presents here, right,
no.
when he's going to these outsider people.
No.
Lewis's
subtle line was about heaven. He said, there are going to be a lot of surprises.
Yeah.
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 Now, when an Englishman says that,
That's saying a lot. All right. Well, it is time for us to take our break. Great first half. Thanks, Wade. We really appreciate you coming to California. Hopefully we can show you a good time tonight. We'll be back on the second half. Maybe we'll get to talk about the book that's in your wheelhouse, as you say. This seems like it's pretty far into your wheelhouse as you talk about it.
Yeah, no, I enjoy it. Thank you.
Welcome to our break. We're going to talk about how you can get the book, Paths Strewn with Sinners, and also Wade's other book, An Uncompromising Gospel. There's two primary sales channels through which you can get that. You can get it at shop.1517legacy.com, or you can get it on Amazon. We've revised the new 1517 store, so instead of just sending people to Amazon, I'm pretty comfortable sending you there now, especially since you can get Paths Strewn with Sinners for, I think, $3 cheaper a book on our website, and free shipping on orders over $20. So if you order two of them, one for you and one to give away, you can get free shipping on that order. I'm going to say that one of the most common emails I get from listeners is books that could be used for Bible studies in congregations or in groups. And I think A Paths Strewn with Sinners is excellent for that. So people looking for maybe that next Bible study topic, this is actually a Bible study. It's actually going into Mark, and so this could be a very useful tool for groups like that. It's priced reasonably, so you can buy it in bulk at 1517, and if you want to do a bulk order for a church Bible study, you can email me on the contact page on the Thinking Fellows, and we do discounts at bulk rates on books as well, so you can do that. So again, that's shop.1517legacy.com. Right now, it is the big book plastered on the front page, so you can find it there.
You made the headline.
Nice. I finally hit the big time.
That's right. And it'll also be linked in the show notes. You can find it on Amazon as well, where it has free shipping, and if you have a Prime account, of course. And then the second book, An Uncompromising Gospel, same story, shop.1517legacy.com. It's the same price on our website as on Amazon, so shop where you will on that one, but you can bundle it with A Paths Strewn with Sinners
and get
free shipping from our website as well. It supports us. You can then also sign up to get emails from 1517 Legacy from our shop as well, so you'll be notified of future books coming out.
Coupons, possibly.
Yep, possible sales. Sometimes new episodes or exclusive episodes of Thinking Fellows, Rich in the Wasteland, and things like that, so that's always a good thing too. So check it out. All right. So second half of the show, we talked about the new book. Let's talk about An Uncompromising Gospel, like you said, in your wheelhouse. Has everybody here read it? I read it. I thought it was good. I think it's excellent for some of the stuff going on right now in Missouri.
Is it fair to say that you were retracing Bente to do it better?
Well, how it had happened originally was I got invited down to our Nebraska district convention, and they said, you've got 5 hours to, you know, basically tell us why the Reformation matters or what we can learn from it. And so I basically, most of my research has been with studying Matthias Flacius Illyricus and the controversy that broke out over Luther's death between him and Melanchthon and others. And so Scott and I are on other sides of the table on this. Perhaps.
Well, one of the things, the reason I asked this is a pretty simple one. Scott and I both took the course on Melanchthon from Lowell Green.
Okay.
When he was a visiting prof in our MA in Reformation program. And one of the things that Lowell Green said was Bente's tracing of the history of the confessions. One thing characterizes it. He will go out of his way to insult Melanchthon on anything. Yep. Anything.
Yep.
And that's through our whole synod now. There's this kind of... And granted, we all know he made some dumb moves under pressure, and we know what they are. But that wasn't enough for Bente, though he lived earlier.
Well, I'm trying to remember who was the prof at Concordia Seminary, very important for liturgical developments. Began with a P. I don't know why I'm forgetting his name. But he had complained that Bente had made a bunch of flations out of the Synodical Conference or the Missouri Synod. And I think, you read Bente, and it's almost like hagiography for the Gnasios. And then Melanchthon comes off as you only meet Melanchthon largely after Luther's death.
Yep.
And you guys had
Nestigan on
talking about, you know, and Kolb has talked about how to be more fair.
After 1525, yeah.
Yeah, and so I think one of the things that I've worked through with Melanchthon and Flacius stuff is Flacius never talked about Melanchthon that way. Flacius always talked about Melanchthon with great respect and tries not to name him even when he's attacking him. I was telling Scott last night, holds up his Lotzi, especially the 1521, is something that everybody should be reading and studying.
That's what Luther said. It was let down from heaven.
Yeah, and then you get, though, through Bente, you know, I think a presentation that even Flacius would have been uncomfortable with himself, probably. Although, you know, he gets a little more outspoken as time goes on.
But yeah, he does. Let's
people
be fair.
People forget the decades that happened between that, though, at the time of the controversy.
So,
not so much.
I want to set this up a little bit for the listeners who have no idea what we're talking about at this point. So within Lutheranism.
That's me, by the way.
Okay,
just joking.
That's good. Well, that's a problem, actually. within Lutheranism, you know, it's a movement that starts 1517, right? But there's a whole period of development, which you could argue lasts until the Formula of Concord. 1577, 1578, that where Lutherans, quote unquote, are working stuff out, beliefs out, doctrines out, teachings out, preaching, catechesis, all that's sort of getting worked out. And one of the ways it gets worked, a couple of ways this gets worked out are through writing confessions, through writing what we now call systematic or dogmatic theologies, like the Loci Communis, which are just sort of expressions of how to teach a particular doctrine like sin or grace or whatever. And then the other way, or maybe two more ways it gets worked out, is by people going off to other lands and talking with the political and theological representatives from other lands. And then the fourth way, maybe one of the more important ways that it gets worked out, is through correspondence or through letters, right, between individuals. Hey, I saw you wrote this. I think you're wrong. Why don't you say it this way? No, I'm right, you know, put it where light doesn't shine. I'm going to write it the way I want to write it, that type of thing. Yeah. And one of the things that we miss out on is that it was a very polemical age, where when they wrote letters to each other and when they argued with a lot of zeal behind them. And that's something that we
foreign to our culture.
Foreign to our culture. They would use every trick in the book. They would use every...
Insult
they could, every methodology they could to get their point across. And when Rod is referring to Bente, what he's referring to is that throughout the... So if you remember, I said one of the ways that we worked this out was by writing confessions, right? Confessions, we believe this, we believe that. Lutherans put together a set of confessions called the Book of Concord, and just bring it into English, it'd be the Book of Unity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or of peace. This is what we agree on. We're trying to settle the conflicts. We agree on this, and it's comprised of several different confessions, most of them written by Melanchthon, three of them written by Martin Luther, and the last one written by both of their students, right? That's called the Formula of Concord. And Bente, Friedrich Bente, is an early American Lutheran who writes, based on really a German Lutheran text by Kolbe, sort of writes a history of how we got this Book of Concord.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're saying is that he's not very fair to one of the main characters that helped figure out what Lutheranism would look like, and that's Philip Melanchthon. Yeah. And that there is another character who comes really later, into prominence later, Matthias Flacius, or as Jim likes to say, he says to upset the LCMS folks, Flacius, that, you know, he's on the other, in a lot of ways, on the other side of working some of this stuff out.
Yeah. And even with Bente, you know, the reason he influenced so many, too, is that at the seminaries, many are using the Concordia Triglotta for their Book of Concord, which has the German, Latin, and English. And included in that, in the front...
is Bente.
Yeah, is Bente.
Yep.
So this is an easy go-to.
For listeners, think of it this way. Let's say that when you were taking 10th grade American history, that every student across the United States was assigned the exact same history book to learn American history, and it had some seminal flaws in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yet for 100 years, we stuck with that and only assigned that.
Yep.
And if you had any introduction to American history, you were reading out of that book, flaws and all.
Yep.
That's what's happened. What we're saying is that's what's happened with training pastors, especially in the LCMS, over the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm. And the text included with the very confessional text you subscribe to.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we could get into what impression that might, you know,
right.
give
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's one of, and Bente is one of the translators on that text that they're using. So that Concordia Triglotta, it gives the German original, the Latin original, and then it gives a translation into English, and Bente is one of the translators there. And if you've ever done any translating, it's a good translation. I'm not saying it's not, but if you've ever done any translating, you know you can sort of, you can influence things a little bit too by the way you translate.
Mm-hmm.
Every translation is an interpretation.
To some degree, yeah.
To some degree.
To some degree it is. That's why it's good. I mean, even like with the scriptures, if you only read scriptures in English, it's great that we have multiple translations of the scriptures because you can lay them all down on the table. And if you were to do that, you'd probably get a pretty good idea of what one translation is missing from the Greek and what the other one has. And you can do that with the confessions now too. I mean, there are so many translations of the Lutheran confessions, from Jacob to the Bente to Kolbwanger to Tappert, that you could lay them all down on the table and you can really get a good scope of what the Latin and the German is getting across by just sort of doing the interlinear version of the translations.
Yeah. And so when in putting this together, this district convention is then lay people and teachers and pastors. And so the hope was something that would be, you know, helpful or educational to theologically interested lay people as well. And so it starts with what I think are the two documents that the fights are that happen later are addressed in, which is the Heidelberg Disputation, which is Luther's very early 1518 statement, where he's starting to understand some of the contrast between law and gospel.
The law says do this and it's never done. Grace says do this or believe this and it's
all done already.
Yeah, talk about wonderful bookends to the theological theses there. Yeah. 1 and 28, if you go and you read those, that's a sandwich. And then the bondage of the will, which you guys have done episodes on, so I won't belabor. But what happens is after Luther's death, a lot of the controversies that break out are about these very central teachings of Luther's theology. And we can ask ourselves, well, how could everybody be so wrong on that? This was the heart of the Reformation. And so it kind of traces how these played out and then how some of these were solved leading up to the Formula of Concord.
Yeah, so I like to tell people that have no sort of acquaintance with this other than they know that there's this thing called Lutheran, there's this thing called Luther, right? So if you think of Lutheranism being an expression of Martin Luther's theology, and you say that it started around 1520, right? That's a good rounding, right? It started 1517, 1518.
50, 51 with Galatians, maybe?
Yeah.
I'm guessing at the date of Galatians. Sorry.
Yeah, but that he dies in 1546, right? So you have about 25 years, give or take some years, of Luther's influence on Lutheranism. And then we don't get the Formula of Concord, which kind of, to use your phrase, bookends our theology until the late 1570s with Book of Concord 1580, right? And so you have about another 25 years on the other end, give or take some years, where Luther's direct influence is not available on Lutheranism.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, and other things happening historically, you know, the Smalcaldic Wars, the emperor coming up and basically taking back over by force, re-Catholicizing the regions by force. And it's turbulent, to say the least. I think an amount of turbulence that we don't understand really or comprehend.
You know, when I teach it, I usually, you know, everything went to hell in a handbasket like that.
Yeah.
Luther dies, the territories are invaded, there's a new prince over the portion of Saxony where the University of Wittenberg is. You lost the prophetic voice of Luther, and everybody's looking at Philip. You know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And he's looking behind him saying, what are you looking at?
And not only for theological questions, but things with serious political implications as well. And so, you know, one of the, I guess maybe to just get to the end, something I do there, as someone who studies the polemics of this age and largely propaganda wars, was speaking to a district convention, I kind of viewed it as an opportunity to say, well, how can we get the best of the theology while avoiding some of what led to the problematic dynamics? And Missouri's bigger than my synod, the Wisconsin synod, but you know, in our system, everybody goes to one seminary, all the pastors, and many of them go to one college, and many of them go to one of two prep schools for high school. And you come out assuming, well, everybody means the same thing and had the same teachers and speaks the same language. And so when something happens, it can be really easy to jump on things and well, that's not how we speak, or that's not how we do, or whatever. And then it can personality. You know, you have 12 years together. Some people, personalities come into play. We played football together. How can this come up? Whatever the case may be, you know, Missouri. You have the two seminaries, and but I think some of those dynamics, to where we can somewhat sometimes. Rather than listening and trying to find out why is someone saying this and what are they after, maybe they're not out to undo the whole Christian faith.
Yes.
And, yes. You know, that you have in this conflict that followed, these men all studied or taught at Wittenberg. Right. I mean, they were all students of Luther. And the assumption is...
And Melanchthon.
Yeah, and we all took the same thing away from him.
Yeah.
Well, no, they had different experiences. The theologian is formed in his experiences. Two guys that are out in the parish 15 years are very different than they were when they were in seminary. Hopefully they're still Orthodox Lutherans, but they've had different experiences ministering to different people. And
perspectives change.
Yeah, and so how can you talk in a way that we understand what our brother, you know, or you know, those in fellowship with us are trying to do, and what they're teaching in a way that's responsible rather than causing harm both to the people being served and to the people serving by unnecessary attacks.
Yeah. So what are, Adam can help with this too, because Adam knows these histories like crazy, but what are some of the controversies that are going on at this point that you write about?
Well, I kind of run through some of just, and a lot of this I'll admit is covered by Bente too, and some I wanted to give a little bit different background, and some of this may be more pastoral, but the two of them that stand out to me, well, the big one that starts it all is over Adiaphora, and that's why I love studying.
Which means what?
And that's what I'm going to get to. That's why I love studying this era, because Adiaphora for Lutherans means get out of jail free card. It means
I
don't have to explain to you now what I'm doing or what I'm not doing. And so there's some people that word Adiaphora drives nuts because it means that someone's doing something different than them, and they're trying to say maybe there's Christian freedom to do that. For others, it becomes a way of doing something without being willing to say, how does this further the confession?
Well, the basic idea, if I understand correctly, is you don't absolutize something for which Scripture doesn't demand it nor forbid it, either one. You're in that gray area.
Yep, it's indifferent. It's a middle dinga. It's, and so it's a controversy over things that are supposed to be indifferent that blows up into all these controversies that follow over things that are far from indifferent, original sin, free will, good works, things of this nature. And so I think it's interesting that out of this initial fight that is over, you know, things neither forbidden or commanded, you have the fault lines that develop for things that are extremely important. So you may have someone who's worshiping a little bit different than you but agrees with you on original sin and free will, and you may have someone who's worshiping the same as you because of the interims, whatever.
And differs
on essential doctrines, and I think sometimes that's an important reminder for us as well.
Right.
The one that I face all the time, because the audience I'm in a lot, is the section on election, and it's in the formula.
Yeah.
People have no idea what Lutherans hold. They know that Luther wrote The Bondage of the Will. That's a clue. But in detail, we have not gotten that out at all.
Yeah.
I come from a synod where there really was belief in free will. It was worked out in a strange way that God's knowledge of the future, that is, he knew that you would come to believe in Jesus, was the basis of election back in eternity. That's what I didn't know it at the time, but that was their position.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I love my son, because I know when he's 18, he's going to get a good job or go to college, right?
Anyway, so then I come to Missouri and find this marvelous doctrine of election with regard to the saved only, and a refusal to take the obvious next step. And I thought, there it is. There's what I want to confess. That's just one example.
Yeah. And you cover the antinomian controversy in there, right? Which is sort of controversies.
I don't, not as much. You know, Agricola, I'm trying to think, may come up a little. But that would have been a more timely one had I had about another year or two I originally wrote that, this. But, you know, that's an interesting one,
that's
too.
That's an amazing story. Yeah. Six times, I think, or five, he said to Luther, okay, I'll quit teaching that the regenerate don't need the law preached to them. I'll stop. And 2 years later, he's doing it again, and we're back to it again. He makes the same promise to Luther. Okay, I will not any longer teach that the regenerate don't need the law preached to them. And 2 years later, he's doing it again.
Yeah. And it, I do get it,
he
Scott.
He has a short memory.
Yeah. I do get it, Scott, with Amsdorf and Major. So not the earlier controversy with Agricola, but, you know, what is the role of good works in salvation?
Majoristic.
Yeah, and then Amsdorf as well, saying, well, this is detrimental.
Yeah.
By the way, no one comes out against Amsdorf officially. He's kind of the grandpa of Gymnasial Lutheranism. Yes. And everybody knows, okay, we can understand him rightly. He's getting that.
I understand how he got on a roll and got to saying they're the absolute enemy of justification. And I understand that.
It's kind
of
like when Jim Nestigan says something now that people are kind of questioning. They go, oh, it's grandpa.
Yeah.
No, but I understand that. He was so opposed to it that he went hyperbolic, as Luther sometimes would do, and the language was hyperbole. It just was.
Yeah. Well, and he's reacting, too. I mean, this ties back to the synergistic controversy, which is over, you know, the role of free will and things of this nature. And in many ways, the antinomian debates that are happening today are an attempt to get my will back.
Back in
some meaningful way.
Yep.
Rather than just I have a new man who spontaneously does good works to get, well, but I'm helping.
The spontaneous thing worked in you isn't enough, you know.
Yeah.
God, look at me. I want to get my will back in so that I can say I chose to do it and therefore jump around and go, look at me. I'm doing a good thing.
Yeah, it's not like two oxen pulling a cart. And I always use the illustration of when we first moved to Milwaukee, I had a smaller yard and I got this kind of hippie reel mower because I thought I'd save gas. And it took forever to mow, and it drove me nuts because I got kids in club ball, and I didn't mow enough. And sometimes my daughter would say, well, I want to help. Well, she's 5 years old at the time, and she only made the job harder, so it took twice as long and two more PBRs. But by the time I got done, she could say to me, look, Dad, I mowed the lawn. And I could say, yes, you did, sweetheart. Thank you.
Yeah.
But she didn't, right? She did not carry out the predominant role in mowing the lawn.
The one that stands out to me is that pericope on the sheep and the goats and where the Lord says you helped me and you did this.
Look at all these things you've done. Yeah.
And the recipient said, when did we do that?
I got it right here in my good work
journal. No, just the opposite.
All right, we need to wrap up. So Wade, I know who I think should buy this book, and I think anybody interested in Lutheran history would be interested in this book at all. Anybody, if you're even from the outside and you're kind of like, what are these Lutherans? Why did they end up so weird?
Why did they keep fighting each other? Yeah.
You should get this book, and it's a very balanced, and by that I mean not inaccurate, but balanced in the sense of you don't do the thing, you're not coming in with an agenda against any particular character in the story. But I especially think anybody that's in, you know, a class maybe in their church where they're covering the Lutheran Confessions. Certainly if you're an undergrad studying Lutheran Confessions, if you're a seminarian, you know, there's a new historical introduction to the Book of Concord by Kolb Arndt Nestigen, which is outstanding.
Very good. Very well done.
Very well done. The footnotes in the first three chapters are great. But other than that, this is a good add-on. The reason it's a good add-on is because it actually... It's a history in the way that the other one is more of a narrative, right? I mean, one of the things that makes that Kolb Arndt Nestigen book so good is it's actually, they're telling a story there.
Mm-hmm.
And it reads like they're telling a story, and it makes it just a wonderful read. And yours does too, but you actually, there's a history going on here that follows these different controversies in a systematic way that is very helpful addition to that. And it really does explain, you know, why we are kind of the way we are, why we tend to disagree with each other, and that these disagreements, you know, go back 500 years, and that they're in a lot of ways that the disagreements are important to what we're trying to do, which is to express the truth of Scripture clearly and accurately.
When we lose those tensions, we lose something too.
Yeah.
Another one that I've used in the parish, it's a series, and it comes out of the ELS bookstore in Mankato. They're a series of 8.5 by 11 workbooks in the best sense of that, and go through each confession in a finite number of pages. The series is called I Believe.
Yeah, they're good.
And it's a marvelous short intro, usable in the parish. I actually did that, and people
did it. They love it.
Yeah.
I mean, we lie to ourselves when we think, you know, that the parishioners in given whatever church don't want to learn this stuff, yeah, or that it'll be over their heads. I mean, that's just arrogance on our part. They do want to learn it. This is a great resource to do in that. I think people need to head over to shop1517legacy.com.
You always forget the dot. Shop.1517legacy.
I was told yesterday by somebody who's very important to our organization that he loves my advertisements, so shush. shop.1517legacy.com. Pick up both books, Past Room with Sinners and Uncompromising Gospel. If you order both of them, you're going to get free shipping from our store, and you're going to pay less than on Amazon. Wade, thank you so much for being on the show. We might be able to convince you to stick around to do another one.
I appreciate it. If I can just one last plug building on Caleb before.
Yeah, go for it.
A Past Room with Sinners is not an academic commentary on Mark. This is for Bible studies, for individuals'
Good.
Devotions.
Great.
And the subtitle of the title is A Devotional Study of Mark's Gospel. So if you're a layperson, we just talked a lot of academic theology or higher Lutheran theology. This is meant for just individuals or Bible classes that want to walk through Mark's Gospel.
Great.
Yeah, I love it. All right. Thanks, Wade. Thanks, Rod. Thanks, Adam.
All right. We'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.